Hello and welcome to Geek Culture Online, your destination of all things geek. I am your host, Patrick Bolin. Today's episode, the theme is going to be animals. Now, first, some housekeeping. Yes, last week's episode, we had some microphone issues. We are fully aware of that, and hopefully, we have addressed those issues. We are blaming Hydra or the Sith.
Sith.
Yeah, you take your pick. All right, next, we know that you have gone to our Facebook page. I see the traffic. That's awesome, wonderful. But we need to click like so we know what you like and what you don't like. We need to go to our website and comment and click the likes on there too. We see that you're doing. We're seeing that you're going there, but you're not interacting with us. We need to, without telling us what us and interacting with us, we don't know what you like and what you don't like. Otherwise, we're just going to do what we like.
Great.
Now, you don't tell us what we don't tell us. We will continue and to let us me talk with a whole hour about what's bouncing around in my head. And yes, that was a threat, and that was very convoluted. But you get the drift. Now we're also on the website. We're going to change a few things around. There are some things that people haven't been going to for a while, so we're going to change things up a little bit. I'm going to change some of the pages around and some of the formatting around and see if you like it. And if you don't tell us, we don't know about that. Also, we are still taking applications for our graphic designer. We've gotten some, but we want this to open up to everybody. So you can go to our webpage and directly email me at patrick@geekculture.online. And in the subject line, put graphic art. Please include a link to your artwork. You don't need to send us stuff because large graphics in the emails just jam the box up. So send us a link to like the DeviantArt page or wherever you have your art located, and we'll take a look there. And also, we are still taking applications for music. Gotten some great, wonderful examples of some music, but we want this open to everybody. So if you're a musician and you do music and you want some free advertising, send us an email. Send it to me at Patrick Geek Culture Online with the subject line of music talent with a brief intro and a link to your work. We want this. We want to see what you can do. And hey, everybody's going to see it or listen to it in this case. So hey, send it out. Now on with the show. I am here with our recurring guest, Larry Wojciechowski, and today we are going to be geeking out about animals.
Hey everybody, hey Patrick.
Hey. Now, to continue what we've been doing, we're going to start our first segment out on comic books again. We're going to open up the long box and we're going to go in there. And in this case, we're going to pull out one of my favorites of mine. And it's been around, it's a character that's been around for a little while, but has not really gotten her own title, it's a she, until recently. First, a little bit of back history that we're going to be talking about Marvel Comics. Now, Marvel Comics started in 1939 as Timely Publications. And by the early 1950s, it had generally become known as Atlas Comics. Now, the Marvel branding as we know it today was started in 1961, and that was the year the company launched some of the biggest titles that we know about, the Fantastic Four, the Amazing Spider-Man, the Incredible Hulk, and many, many other titles. Now, these fantastic characters were created by Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, yeah, one of my favorite artists, and many, many others. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to jump ahead in time about 20 years to the 80s. Now, we're going to talk about one of my favorite characters, comic book character known as Squirrel Girl.
Squirrel Girl, or Doreen Green, her first appearance was in the Marvel Superheroes Volume 3, Number 8, otherwise known as Marvel Superheroes Winter Special, with the cover date of Winter 1991. In a story plotted and drawn by Steve Ditko and script writer Will Murray,
One of my favorites.
her ability to communicate with squirrels is surprisingly effective and has allowed her to defeat major supervillains, which to me is just shocking. I never heard of this Squirrel Girl. I barely knew of her, barely knew of her, but I love her now. I really love the comic now. Her ability to communicate, and sorry, with squirrels, I think is I'm still a little dumbfounded by the concept personally, but it's such an original idea and such a different take, not just because she's a woman, but just anyway, we'll discuss a little bit more.
Okay.
Anyway, she joined the Great Lakes Avengers, but left to move to New York City, where she served as a nanny to Danielle Cage, the daughter of Luke Cage and Jessica Jones. I'm sure those names sound familiar to you, Patrick, and our listeners.
Yes.
In her solo series, the character splits her time between studying computer science at Empire State University and fighting crime both solo and as a member of the Avengers.
Yes. She is an Avengers member. And, you know, the Avengers go back to 61, so their roster has grown and shrunk over the years.
Yes, yes. Again, this is just shot. I mean, I think this is just a fascinating comic. If you haven't read it, I think you should pick it up, honestly. Squirrel Girl's creation arose from Will Murray's desire to write a lighthearted superhero story as opposed to the often heavy dramatic tales that were the norm in mainstream comics at the time. In that issue, she ambushes the superhero Iron Man, then teams up with him, and after Iron Man is captured, defeats the villainous Doctor Doom.
Hands down, by herself.
Which again, is just, you see this woman, I mean, again, it's not that she's a woman, it's just, you think, squirrels? How can this be a superpower?
Yeah, she doesn't have any armor, she doesn't have any special gimmicks.
No, I think it's a fascinating spin on superheroes, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. The story with the volume 3, number 8, it also introduces her squirrel sidekick, Monkey Joe.
Yeah, I feel sorry about Monkey Joe. Something that probably Larry doesn't know about is that Monkey Joe is no longer with us.
Oh, no, I don't know that. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, with that, Will Murray has since described the character's genesis. And here's a quote. "Actually, I created Squirrel Girl in script form without any artist input. Tom Morgan was originally going to draw it, but when he dropped out, I requested Ditko and got him.
Boom.
Ditko got a great job in bringing my baby to life. He invented the knuckle spike. It wasn't in the script. I based Squirrel Girl, ironically enough, on a long-ago girlfriend who read comics and was into critters, wild animals of all types. Coincidentally, she was a big Ditko fan. I think I got the idea because I had a bunch of squirrels running around my roof and sometimes coming in through my open bedroom window, and inspiration struck." That's a quote from Will Murray, you know, the man behind Squirrel Girl. Again, just fascinating to me. Since then, she appears off and on over the years, either in one-panel appearances or as a trading card in Fleer's Skybox, and other small appearances in various titles.
Yeah, that was a trading card series that it was in the 90s. I have some of them, but I never got her card.
You know, I do remember, I think I have some of those cards, but again, I think Squirrel Girl never came up, so I was ignorant of the whole situation. Almost a decade later, she's referenced only once in comics during that time, in Deadpool number 7.
Yes.
Deadpool's friend, mother figure, prisoner, Blind Al, mentions accidentally putting bleach in with Deadpool's Squirrel Girl underoos. And again, this is news to me. I mean, you really have to be an aficionado of Marvel and comics. And I think of myself as a pretty good follower of this stuff. But again, never heard of Squirrel Girl before, you know, until recently. So anyway.
I fell in love with it from the beginning. But during Marvel's 2006 Civil War company-wide story arc that happened at the time, Squirrel Girl and the rest of the team, the Great Lake Avengers, fought Deadpool in Cable and Deadpool number 30. And in 2007, she and a newly renamed, it was from the Great Lake Avengers to the Great Lake Initiative, again appeared alongside Deadpool in the Deadpool / GLI Summer Fun Spectacular one-shot issue. Now, in September 2010's release of the five-part storyline I Am an Avenger, Squirrel Girl appears in the first issue in the story, Welcome Home, Squirrel Girl. The premise of the story was simply Squirrel Girl coming home to Manhattan. Now, Squirrel Girl appears as a supporting character sporadically in the from 2010 to 2013 New Avengers series from issue 7, February 2011, through its final issue, number 34 of January 2013. She's not a member of the team, but works as a super-powered nanny caring for the daughter of Luke Cage and Jessica Jones, which was was previously mentioned by Larry, while at the same time attending the New York University.
Anyway, so the unbeatable Squirrel Girl, which is on the cover of this issue that I just read recently, and again, fascinating. On October 6, 2014, Marvel announces Squirrel Girl would, for the very first time, be starring in her own series.
Awesome.
Named The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, written by Ryan North and drawn by Erica Henderson. The series' first issue was released on January 7th, 2015.
I fell in love with it at that point.
Again, I love just one issue. I mean, it's shocking to me. The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl ran for 8 issues before being rebooted in October 2015 as part of the all-new, all-different Marvel branding, with Squirrel Girl being part of the New Avengers. Since then, The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl has continued monthly publication with the same creative team.
Yeah, like the issue that we just got through reading, which was number 10. Number 10. Mole Man tries to woo her and date Squirrel Girl. And that kind of was an interesting.
Now, I've heard of Mole Man before and other, maybe other Marvel or comics or TV series. So Mole Man, I had known of, as a nemesis, as a bad guy, mm-hmm. so to speak. I don't remember too much about him. This is from years ago. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Mole Man, Squirrel Girl, this is like, my concept of comic book heroes, mm-hmm. superheroes, or villains, and then I come to this, just expanded my, it literally expanded the universe of what I will take in as a comic book superhero or not.
Oh, you should also look into Ambush Bug.
Okay. All right. Next time. Next podcast. Some other podcast, Patrick. Come on.
All right. The series popularity. Oops. Wait. The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl rant. Oh, no, you already read that. The series popularity soon led to spinoffs. Strong sales at school book fairs encouraged the team to develop an original graphic novel. The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl beats up the Marvel Universe, which was released in October 2016 for the new school year. Now, while Henderson told The Hollywood Reporter balancing the graphic novel and the monthly series was almost too much work, which is understandable, writing a book and a monthly comic book series, North expressed the interest in doing another graphic novel and calling it a fun challenge. Now, in May 2016, Marvel Press announced the husband and wife team of Shannon and Dean Hale were writing a YA, what was called a young adult novel, The Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, Squirrel Meets World, that would be released in February 2017.
Anyway, since January 2017, everybody and Patrick, Squirrel Girl has appeared in U.S. Avengers, a replacement title for the New Avengers.
Yes, and to a little slight thing is that Marvel at the time was kind of doing a soft reboot of all their titles, and that's why that landed there.
Okay, so let's talk, and this is the most fascinating thing to me.
This is the part I love.
Right, this is, for anybody who's, hasn't picked up one of these comics, I really, really think you should. So let's just talk about her powers and abilities. Because you think Squirrel Girl, well, it's kind of self-explanatory, but let's dig into it. So here, powers and abilities of her. During Squirrel Girl's first encounter with Iron Man, she provided a detailed demonstration of her powers and abilities.
Which are?
A furry, prehensile tail, I kid you not, mm-hmm. roughly 3 to 4 feet in length, sizable buck teeth, mm-hmm. which are strong enough to chew through wood, and superhuman strength and agility, enabling her to jump between trees with ease, mm-hmm. like a squirrel, right?
Yes.
Her fingers have sharp claws on them, assisting her with climbing, and she possesses retractable knuckle spikes, which are roughly 2 to 3 inches in length on each hand. Mm-hmm. Most importantly, she is capable of communicating, and again, this is true, with and understanding squirrels. Squirrel Girl does not communicate with squirrels telepathically.
Nope.
Instead, she has an understanding of their language and the ability to speak it. Squirrels have also been depicted as understanding her when she speaks in English.
Yes. Yeah. Later, appearances have revealed additional abilities possessed by Squirrel Girl, including heightened reflexes, which she dubs as Squirrelgility, and vision. Her eyes have been seen to glow red in low light situations. And she also, at times, displayed an enhanced sense of smell, kind of like a Wolverine. Now, Squirrel Girl has also revealed that her lips taste like hazelnuts, though that attribute has since been reconned by the Unbelievable Squirrel Girl writer Ryan North. She also has a superb hand-to-hand combat capabilities, taking down Wolverine in a one-to-one, no-claws fight.
Right, and again, just going on, which is, again, still almost dumbfounding to me sometimes. Squirrel Girl carries a utility belt comprising multiple pouches that contain nuts to give as snacks to her squirrel friends, mm-hmm. which makes sense. I mean, honestly, that makes sense because if they're helping you fight, you don't want to be hungry,
it's
right?
Almost like her utility belt.
Right, right. A la Batman, but yes. Snacks. Anyway, they're known humorously as her nut sacks. Get it? Ha, ha, ha. Anyway, it was originally unknown whether the black markings around her eyes are the result of her mutation or cosmetically applied to enhance her Skrull-themed appearance, though they did not appear to smear when she's crying. In New Avengers Annual Number 1, she is shown in casual clothes lacking these markings.
Well, I think it's mostly because of the interpretation of whatever artist is drawing her at the time. But, you know, she is seen a lot with that. But, again, it may be just to the artist's discretion.
Yeah, I mean, when I was reading the comic book, Patrick, I mean, I did notice that, you know, I noticed the black.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, sometimes I noticed it, sometimes I didn't. So mm-hmm. it wasn't like anything. It didn't draw me into it. I mean, it wasn't a very important topic. It wasn't that I cared about. I mean, I cared more about the teeth, her tail, jumping around, you know,
yes.
All that stuff. So anyway, Squirrel Girl is also shown carrying a full set of Iron Man versus series battle cards, which she uses to show Dum Dum Dugan how she knows him. She mentions Dugan has a defense stat of 8. Her own is 6. Although the rating system is left unclear, meaning I guess 8 would be better. I don't know. Who knows?
Yes.
Anyway, after MODOK is pointed out to her, she consults the supervillain's own card to confirm his abilities.
Mm-hmm.
The printing on the two cards shown, Dugan's and MODOK's, is actually gibberish.
Yeah, when you see it, you can't really read it, and it's, you know.
Okay, in the comics. So yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha. In her solo series, Unbeatable Squirrel Girl, she has a set of Deadpool's Guide to Supervillains cards to help her identify villains and their possible weaknesses. She is known to be able to defeat all her opponents, which we will not go into here because it's a long list, which, again, you told me, Patrick.
Yeah. She's completely, utterly undefeated. She has never lost a battle, and that's against people. You know, there's been, like, single-panel pictures of showing Galactus laying flat on his back after being defeated by him. Thanos, you know.
Thanos was the supervillain in Guardians of the Galaxy. How do you beat? They couldn't even beat Thanos.
Yeah.
Is he still alive?
Yeah. You know, but
how'd she beat him?
Yeah, but she's you know.
Don't
again,
tell us.
It's hilarious. You have to go back and find all her old issues because most of them, until she got her own series, were single panel, you know, just humorous, you know, exploits. But yeah, it's really, really, really awesome. And that's why I love the character so much.
Anyway, most recently, a live-action half-hour comedy series based on the New Warriors superhero team titled Marvel's New Warriors is being developed by Marvel Television and ABC Studios and will feature Squirrel Girl as a member of the team.
Awesomeness.
Which I'm looking forward to now. Yeah. The series received a straight-to-series order on Freeform and was to debut in 2018. On July 10th, 2017, it was announced that Melania Weintraub has been cast as Squirrel Girl. It was announced later in 2017 that Freeform will no longer air the show, and Marvel is now shopping the show elsewhere.
Now, the thing is, ABC didn't want to pick it up. They wanted to put it on cable so they could have a little more freedom with it. You know, they didn't even have to do a pilot. It went right to series.
Interesting. Okay.
Yes. As far as I know, it is has been filmed. Enough of them are in the can to air them. But again, where this will be aired is yet to be seen because I think they're, Marvel and other stations are getting a little gun-shy because of the backlash on Iron Fist, which we'll go into when we get...
Some other time.
Yeah, we'll get into Iron Fist all on its own later on.
Right. Now, you mentioned, I mean, you say in here, you know, Freeform is actually an ABC-owned channel. It used to be ABC Family.
Yes.
So you think since...
Well, they changed the name of it.
Right, right. A while ago.
Yeah, and then they changed what they were going to show on there, and that's
right.
Yeah, this is not the only series that was impacted. They kind of changed their format.
Okay,
a lot.
Okay. Well, but all I'm trying to say is, I mean, you know, Freeform is owned by ABC, which is owned by Disney, and Marvel's owned by Disney. So this is kind of all in the family type of thing. I'm doing air quotes now. So you think they'd want it on Freeform, but it is a kind of a standard cable access channel. It's not Netflix. It's not HBO. You know, it's not Showtime or anything like that. And so it usually, I mean, like Freeform is kind of like a, not to be crude, a younger demographic. I mean, I would think Squirrel Girl would appeal to Freeform audience members.
I thought it was a perfect fit. It just, and I was excited to see it. All the stars aligned, and then
it just didn't happen. Happen. Well, let me give you a little again. So for the maybe people that who don't know and who didn't watch At Midnight, because this woman appeared on At Midnight many times, which is now off Comedy Central. Very sad. Chris Hardwick, I thought was fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so Melania Weintraub was born on March 8th, 1987 in Tashkent, the Uzbek Soviet Socialist Republic at the time. Remember, 1987, it was the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. As Melania Alexandrovna Weintraub.
That's why I had him read that.
Of course, right. Well, I have some East European, I have some Slavic blood in me. Anyway. She is known for her work on This Is Us from 2016.
Love that show.
Love from 2016 and Silicon Valley from 2014.
Yeah, I missed all those episodes.
Yeah, no.
I love that show, but you know, I don't know why, but I missed those that she was on.
I think she got famous from Silicon Valley, honestly. That's what I mean. But anyway, she probably recently, besides the good TV shows, she's appeared as a saleswoman, Lily Adams, in AT&T commercials.
I think that's where everybody remembers
her
from.
So. But honestly, if you're a, and I'm sure you're very, you know, geek type, you know, listeners here, if you're listening to our podcast, and if you're not, that's fine as well.
How dare you?
No harm, no foul. Yeah, I mean, At Midnight was one of my favorite shows. And I mean, I DVR it every night and watch it that same night. And she had been on, you know, several times. Again, it's a show about comedians riffing on current events. At one point, I might have mentioned this in the past, is that they had like a At Midnight Olympics, like during the Summer Olympics of 2016. And she won. Like Monday was a set of three. And then the winner went on to the, you know, final round. So, and then she won. I mean, so she, the actual, is it the, not Uzbek, what, anyway, obviously the flag of the country, yeah, Uzbekistan, I think Uzbekistan, which is now a standalone country, was, you know, they played the national anthem. I guess it was the national anthem. I don't know the national anthem of Uzbekistan. So it was very straight, I mean, very, that's a country we hear a lot about. You know, I mean, and, you know, the Soviet Union is one thing, but obviously the Soviet Union's dead, so.
Well, obviously from her, you know, having her comedic chops there is the probably one of the main reasons why they chose her for Squirrel Girl.
Absolutely.
Because the character is very very comedic and very lampoonish. So having somebody that's able to do that very naturally, I think, you know, just all the stars aligned for that.
I mean, again, when I read the comic, I didn't picture Melania in this role, but once you talk to me about it, we're talking about it now. Now it makes sense because you need the comedy chops, obviously, some, you know, good acting skills, what have you. But the comedy chops are crucial.
Yes, and it doesn't hurt that she's really hot.
Oh yeah, she's very good looking. Wow. Yeah. Anyway,
but yeah. So I want to thank everybody for listening to that. We're going to revisit The Long Box very soon, and you know, just again, Squirrel Girl is one of my favorite characters. And if you want other lampoonish type of characters, Ambush is one of them. And it just, but you know, that's a DC character. But hey, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back right after these few messages.
Bye bye.
Okay, well, do you like to draw?
Do you consider yourself an illustrator?
Would you like others to see your work? Well, here at Greek Culture Online, we are looking for you.
Yes, you.
We need logos. We need web page graphics.
We need you.
Now, you can contact us at patrick@geekcultureonline, and in the subject line, put graphic art. Include a link to your work so we can see your stuff. Hey, doesn't matter, amateur or pro, we want to see your stuff. Now, you show off to your friends and family, providing them, proving to them that doodling on napkins has paid off. Now, remember, it's just like if you're an artist, we want to see your stuff.
Right, everything is up for, you know, our, you know, review, especially by Patrick, and obviously I'm sure I'll get to see it as well. But you know, there's really, in my opinion, no bad art, and you know, I have various loves of art and sculpture, painting, drawing. So don't be shy, send it over, and obviously you'll get feedback from us.
Definitely.
Thank you.
And we're back. Now we're going to be talking about the silver screen once again. And in this case, we're going to be talking about a wonderful movie called Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance. This came out in 2014.
The director, Alejandro González Iñárritu. And again, the tilde is very important. Anyway, born August 15th, 1963. He's a Mexican film director.
Yeah, see, that's why I had him read that too.
Thank you, Patrick. Anyway, written by Alejandro Iñárritu, Nicolás Giacobone, and is a writer and producer known for Birdman or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance from 2014, Beautiful from 2010, and The Revenant from 2015. Great DiCaprio movie.
Awesome. No, go ahead, because you're going to say the names better than I can.
Okay, yeah. I'm the name guy. Anyway,
yes.
Alejandro González Iñárritu is the first Mexican director to be nominated for the Academy Award for Best Director and by the Directors Guild of America for Best Director. He is also the first Mexican-born director to win the Prix de la Mise en Scène, or Best Director Awards, at Cannes, France, in 2006. The second one being Carlos Regalas, in 2012. His six feature films are Amores Perros,
which I didn't see,
from 2000, 21 Grams,
saw that,
from 2003, Babel, from 2006,
saw that,
I saw that, I know that for sure, Beautiful, from 2010,
saw that,
Birdman, from 2014,
awesome,
and The Revenant, from 2015.
Another awesome film.
Yeah. And they've all these movies have gained critical acclaim worldwide, including two Academy Award nominations,
which was pretty amazing.
Yeah, right. He wrote and directed numerous short films and full length films over a long period of time, but we're going to focus on one film, Birdman.
Yes.
In 2014, González Iñárritu directed Birdman, starring Michael Keaton, Naomi Watts, Ed Norton, Emma Stone, Zach Galifianakis, and Andre Riseborough. The film is Iñárritu's first comedy.
Yes.
The film was released on October 17, 2014. And in 2015, Iñárritu won the Academy Award for Best Director, Best Original Screenplay, and Best Picture for Birdman, or The Unexpected Virtue of Ignorance, of 2014. The following year, he won the Academy Award for Best Director for The Revenant, making him only the third director to win back-to-back Academy Awards, the first since 1950.
Which is amazing. Absolutely. Now the plot, Birdman, is about an actor who plays an iconic superhero and who tries to revive his career by doing a play based on Raymond Carver's short story, What We Talk About When We Talk About Love. Now, what's very unique about the film was that it was shot in 2 months, including the rehearsals. 2 months, 60 days. There are only 16 visible cuts in the entire film. Now, because the film is designed to look like one long, uninterrupted shot, no scene could be cut or discarded in post-production. Let that sink in. This led to the script taking an unusually long time to finish, as the writers had to make sure that they were happy with every single scene. Nothing could be filmed or edited out. So everything that was written down, it was very compact and tight.
Right, and Patrick and I were talking about this a little bit, but we wanted to share it really with you, listeners, is that you said it was a distraction, Patrick. I liked it, and I knew this before I watched the movie, so I knew that there are single shots and that there's long, long, like wide pan shots, which again, I loved. They didn't distract me. I was kind of almost looking for them. Well, I was looking for that those wide angle shots, those pan shots, and I liked it. I liked that about the movie.
When I first saw it, I saw it an opening day in the theater, because I mostly see my films opening day.
Don't brag.
And about 5 or 8 minutes into it, I went, wait a minute, they haven't cut. And then then I stopped. I almost stopped listening, because the only thing I was doing was looking to see when the cut. I stopped blinking, because I'm going like, I'm going to miss this. And then I realized, oh my God, he's purposely, intentionally doing this.
Right. And again, for listeners, Patrick's much more the director, the cinematographer than I am. I'm much more of the, you know, consumer of this. But at the same time, I mean, this is talked about. I'm sure you saw this is talked about in the papers, all the reviews, and how this is such a very novel way of doing it. And so I was looking for it. I will admit, in the very beginning, I was focused intently on this, and after a while, I didn't ignore it. I would say that it just was another feature, but it does kind of throw you off kilter a little bit. It kind of, because you're, I don't know, I guess you're so used to cuts and scenes from most movies. I mean, it's standard any movie that this, the flow, you know, there's it almost feels like you're in the theater. And so,
It's
and
almost
that's
like
a,
watching a play.
it's like watching a play. It's like being the video recorder of a home movie. And obviously, it's not a home. They're in a theater. They're in, you know, on Broadway. But you have, it's a, it is a, for, at least for me, it was a much more intimate viewpoint of what's going on behind the stage, behind this play going on, some actions of the actors and the characters in the movie. But yeah, in the beginning, I focused on it. But after, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 minutes, I was buried in the movie. You know, so I wasn't really looking for that as much. It just became maybe second nature.
It became very mind-blowing for me.
Okay.
It just because you know after I finally found a cut, I relaxed,
Okay.
and
Okay.
it just and it just and then I the only thing that was in the back of my mind was like, how many takes did this take? How many times
Sure.
did they had to do this? Because you know you can't you can't just say, oh, I'm gonna put a cut in here. They had to rewind to the point where the last
True.
cut just started over again.
Right. I mean the meticulous timing for these scenes, Patrick and everybody else, meant that the takes were canceled because, as you said, the slightest mishaps. Emma Stone, in an interview with Jimmy Fallon, recalled how a 6-minute take of the scene where Regan first meets Mike was ruined after she walked around a corner too quickly. So because of this, the number of takes for a given scene was high, usually 20 for shorter scenes, the takes running smoothly around the 15th. You know, so ca the camera operator Chris Haroff described it as a type of a dance where everyone would hopefully try to peek at all the same moment. And I guess now after, and I didn't see that interview, I guess now after thinking about that, it makes more sense how certain scenes played out in the movie. But again, you know, after the initial, you know, first 15 minutes,
It
it
was
just
a
flowed nicely.
Well, yeah, it was almost a dance because just think how the rehearsals were. Because not only did you have to memorize your dialogue, you had to memorize how fast or how slow and what you were
Right, right,
moving,
right, right,
you know,
right, right.
placing of props, picking up props,
Right.
everything. It just everything had to be choreographed to the letter.
Right. I mean, because the movie was carefully rehearsed and shot in sequence, editing only took 2 weeks,
Which is amazing.
which has got to be the fastest, one of the fastest ever
Well, yeah, because
for a major motion picture.
Well, yeah, well, it was very, very fast because, you know, just, you know, if you have a 60-day, you know, filming time, it takes months and months and months to edit because you have to edit and edit and edit and edit. And there's reshoots, and then it's like, oh, I need a reverse angle and edit, edit, and edit, edit, and edit. No, just since this was rehearsed to the letter and everything was enormously long takes, the only thing you could do is find the right take.
Correct. Right. So I guess that limits editing, but it's your, yeah. Again, you understand this more than me, and I get what you're saying, Patrick. But again, it's just it's a very different flow the movie had. But you know, according to Alejandro Iñárritu, the director, he had dinner with director Mike Nichols in New York 2 weeks before he began shooting the movie. Iñárritu told Nichols of his plan for how he was going to shoot the movie as one long take. Nichols predicted it would be a disaster, because not having the ability to use cuts and editing would inhibit the opportunities for comedy. Iñárritu said the meeting didn't deter him, but was instead helpful in raising his awareness of the level of difficulty of what he was about to do. Yeah, so I mean, the movie was largely shot inside Broadway's St. James Theater. Michael Keaton and the rest of the cast had to adapt to Alejandro Iñárritu's regular shooting style, which required them to perform up to 15 pages of dialogue at a time when hitting precisely choreographed marks. So I have a question for you, Patrick. You can probably answer this. So in a typical movie scene, or let's say TV, how many pages of dialogue are you?
Well, a normal 2-hour movie is 132 pages.
Right, but like for one scene, how many,
Well,
like a typical
a
actor?
single page is usually a minute.
So a single page, okay, in the script, okay.
Okay, normally. So, right. You know, unless they're just spouting dialogue. Like a Kevin Smith script, if I remember right, Dogma was 258 pages.
Okay.
Which a normal script is 132.
I know that movie. Yeah. I know that movie very
so
well.
So a normal take is less than 8 minutes.
Right.
So that's 8 minutes of, you know, normal. So if you're going to do a scene and out of that 132 pages, you know, and you're only having to memorize 4 to 8 pages of dialogue right. for that one day.
Right, so 15 pages is about 15 minutes. I mean, maybe
15 plus minutes, but that's not only dialogue because a lot of times, you know, the actors and stuff will riff on what they're doing in a scene.
Right.
You know, they're
moving, they're walking, they're jumping, they're yelling,
doing all this stuff, whatever that feels right at the moment. Because the director will say, okay, you know, you need here's start point A, part B. How you get there, I don't care. Make sure you set your lines. No, not only did they had to memorize those 15 pages, they had to memorize exactly what they're going to do, how fast or how slow they were doing it. So the next person is working with him. Like Emma Stone said, she went around the corner too quickly and blew the shot.
Again, I mean, just giving the unusual style of filming these long takes.
Mm-hmm.
Edward Norton and Michael Keaton kept a running tally of flubs made by the actors and actresses, and I can imagine that. I mean, Emma Stone made the most mistakes. Zach Galifianakis made the fewest, which I think is interesting.
Right, yes.
Right. He actually did mess up a few lines during the filming, but played his mistakes off well enough that the shots were included in the film.
So he not only was able to cover up his mistakes, but he didn't break the timing.
Gotcha. And I would say Galifianakis is a great comedian, a very atypical comedian. But yeah, timing would be good. I mean, now that I think about what we're talking about here, yeah, I mean, you could see where Galifianakis could maybe flubbed it, but he's just good enough on his feet that he can cover it.
You know, yeah, because of all his improv skills and everything like that. And he had to not only cover it up, but make sure that he said whatever, how he's covering it up, to the point where it landed so the next person stuff would pick it up. Now, this is not the first we're talking about one takes here, you know, one take films. Now, this is not the first film to attempt to be done in a single take. Now, you can go to Wikipedia and look for one shot films, and they'll give you a tremendous list of films that were either done in one take, attempted to do in one take, or attempted to do in long takes. Now, one of the most famous ones was done by Alfred Hitchcock in 1948 called Rope. It's an 80-minute film.
Master director. And again, if you would ask me off the top of my head what directors would attempt a one-take film, I would probably, after a couple names, I would say probably Hitchcock. I mean, he's a master director, but I've never seen that movie, never heard of it even.
Oh, it was, okay. Well, what's really interesting about Rope is that this is the first film of Hitchcock's Technicolor films, and it was notable for taking place in real time and being edited so it appears as a single continuous shot throughout the use of long takes. Now, the film is one of Hitchcock's most experimental and one of the most interesting experiments ever attempted by a major director working with the big box office names. Now, abandoning many standard film techniques to allow for the long and broken scenes, each shot ran continuously for up to 10 minutes without interruption. It was shot on a single set, aside from the opening establishing shot, street shot, where underneath the credits. Now, camera moves were carefully planned, and there was almost no editing.
And I think, again, what was notable during the filming is that Hitchcock shot for periods lasting up to 10 minutes, the length of a film camera magazine at the time, and continuously panning from actor to actor, though most shots in the film wound up being shorter. Every other segment ends by panning against or tracking into an object, a man's jacket blocking the entire screen, or the back of a piece of furniture, for example. In this way, Hitchcock effectively masked half the cuts in the film.
And also it helped him because, you know, when the film magazine ran out, you replaced it because it was the end, you know, of a shot.
Right. I mean, he had to stop it at that point. So anyway, blocking the camera to switch out film magazines wasn't necessarily in Birdman, but similar techniques were used. Clothing blocked the camera, dark areas of rooms or hallways, objects blocking the camera were all used in Birdman. And again, now that we're talking about this and I'm recalling the movie more and more, now that makes sense.
Yeah.
And again, now I want to see the movie again just to kind of pick up on these clues, if I can pick them up. I don't know if I will.
When I first saw it, I swore up and down that there was only like two or three cuts. Now, finding out that there was 16 after I researched this more, it blows me away, and I want to go see it many, many times so I can sit there and count them out.
Okay, so there's 16 cuts in Birdman Pantry, yes. Right? Okay. So, again, putting on your director's hat, your cinematographer hat, what's an average film these days? What's an average film in, you know, how many cuts?
Hundreds.
Hundreds, really?
You know, it's just like a fight sequence. Okay.
That's true. That's true.
Or a race sequence, or a chase sequence, or special effects.
Right.
You know, it's just a dog fight. Anything like that. Just you can always, directors use cutting to their advantage to show tension. Scenes are very long. When there's a lot of intensity, scenes are cut shorter because, you know, flashing back between things. Right. So modern directors use that to their advantage. And with everything being digital, you're not tied to the size of the film magazine that is being used. You can be as long or short as you want.
A la Hitchcock had that limitation back in the
40s,
right?
But he also, he had customized canisters made so they're able to go longer if you need be. There were several films that were done that way.
Okay. Well, I mean, yeah, and like you said, there are numerous films that have, numerous films have extremely long takes, and several that are filmed in one take, and we can talk about, and we can go on and on.
For hours and hours.
Right, and that's, we don't want to do that. The unique directing style and cinematography made this film. There's no question about it.
Yeah.
In the 1 hour and 59 minute runtime of this film, Birdman, there's, as we said, there's 16 visible edits. In the 1 minute and 47 second premiere trailer, there are over 30 edits, which is almost double, which is shocking. You know, so unique directing styles either make or break a film. In this case, definitely made it. Now, let me say this, and again, we briefly talked about this, and I want to bring it up. I don't want to say I dislike Birdman. I was so intrigued by the lack of editing. Mm-hmm. The long continuous shots. I do like Emma Stone a lot. I do like Michael Keaton. It's a good cast. Emily Watts, Ed Norton, fantastic. I didn't like the movie though, and again, we talked about. I didn't like the movie because it's almost like an insider's inside, I call Hollywood movie. Mm-hmm. It's really about Broadway, though. And again, I have no problem with live plays or Broadway. And for me, it's not that I love every superhero movie. We can talk about how I didn't like Avengers 1 or 2. I did not like them. I did not like the 2009 movie. I did not like them. But I do love superheroes movies. As I said before, my favorite superhero is Batman. And of course, Michael Keaton was the first Batman from the original Batman of 89.
The first modern Batman.
Modern Batman, right, exactly. Right. We're not talking about, we're not talking about the TV series. We're talking about 1989's Batman with the Prince soundtrack, Michael Keaton as the star, the Joker, the beloved Joker that I thought would never be topped, which it was in 2008, of course. And, right, of course. Anyway, and then, of course, the second Batman movie with the Penguin, Danny DeVito's the Penguin. I love those movies. So I love Michael Keaton as a superhero. Mm-hmm. And this one, it's Birdman is his superhero from the past, and he's trying to reclaim his glory by becoming a Broadway star. And I get it. A lot of actors do that for many reasons. I didn't like the insider of the inside. It wasn't bad, and I loved the shots, but, the actors are sleeping with each other. I mean, there were some cliches thrown in that, didn't do anything for me. I like that this play was very fascinating. He has his struggle with the Birdman character, the struggle with his, Emma Stone plays his daughter, so that's a very interesting vibe. If I gave it a rating right now, I rate things on out of 4 stars. Mm-hmm. I would give it, I'd have to see it another time, but I would give it 2.5 stars. Mm-hmm. I know it did a lot better. I mean, people give it 4 out of 4 stars, not knocking it. I had certain expectations, and I'm not saying it didn't meet expectations. It was a beautifully filmed, visually grand, great cast. Mm-hmm. I just don't care. I don't want to see the back of a theater. Sorry, not interesting.
So, ignore the man behind the curtain. You don't want to see behind the curtain. You just want to see it without any of the behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah, I don't hate that stuff. I don't need to see it. It doesn't.
I can name about 4 other movies you're going to actually either hate or love because it's all the same thing.
Give me one.
Hugo.
Hugo?
Yeah.
Didn't see it.
Okay.
Yeah, so. All
right. Okay.
Maybe I shouldn't.
Well,
but
no.
maybe I should, Patrick.
Okay, well, no, there's. We're going to have an entire episode
on
behind the scenes on movies alone, because there's so many out there that are love letters to Hollywood. And it just. And this one isn't really a love letter to Hollywood, but it pulls back the curtain in several ways, but I feel that it's so unique and it you can't compare it to anything else.
Okay, so give me another title besides Hugo.
A silent film. I can't think of
silent movie with Mel Brooks.
No. There was one that came out in 2013. It was done in black and white.
Yes,
and
with the little dog.
Yes.
Yes, and I didn't see that one either. I'll admit I didn't see that.
And that was intentionally filmed in only the ways that were available to cameras back in the 20s.
Right. And so I'm not opposed to seeing that. I wasn't opposed to seeing that movie at all. I just never got onto seeing it. So okay, maybe I should check that one out.
Both of those. Hugo and that one. Both of them. I almost was weeping when I was watching Hugo because it was so well done. And in fact, I have an framed autographed poster of the cast and crew of Hugo hanging in my wall.
Okay, so let me. Okay, so we've talked about that, and I have a question I want to really ask you. Mm-hmm. So I guess, Patrick. You know, you're the director, you know, on the side.
Yeah, if you want to go to my YouTube page, you can see the films I have made.
Yes, please do that. You know, actor as well, right? Mm-hmm. In your various parts and roles, and I appreciate all those. You know, what did you like about this film?
The story I thought was fascinating. It's just the internal struggle of this character that Michael Caine played is just that here was somebody that was trying to, you know, knows that he has more to offer, and it's just that he's completely being haunted by his past. Well, the one thing that everybody loved, but he kept on trying to say, I'm more than this.
That's humanity. Many people
are
like that.
Well, it's just like, somebody gets latched onto a character that they do exceptionally well, and they struggle, or they're typecast forever in that role, and they just say, like, they want to say, I have much more to offer. I am much more than this comedy role, this drama role. I want to
superhero role. Right.
It's just, you know, it's like, quickly off topic, it's like a lot of people from Star Trek couldn't find work after Star Trek because everybody just thought of them in those roles.
The original Star Trek. William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah, just, right. They struggled for a long time. Well, and then it just, then Michael Keaton's role, it just that he was trying to break out of that, saying, look, I'm able to act and I'm going to do this theatrical production. He put everything on the line. Just his character, he put all his money on the line. He put everything on there. Right. It was make it or break it time. He had nothing left to lose.
Right. And again, talking about Michael Keaton, I mean, Michael Keaton was already a pretty big movie star when Batman in 1989 came out. I mean, he already had a good body of work. Mm-hmm. You know, when you said that, you know, how people get typecast, I thought of Christopher Reeve, you know, the original Superman from 1978. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that was an iconic role. You know, I mean, like I said, I'm a Batman guy, but the Superman movies were excellent. Superman 1, Superman 2. Yes, I even love Superman 3. I know people would like to bash it.
No, sir, you're not even saying Superman 4. You didn't mention that at all.
I will not go there. Anyway, but I'm just saying Christopher Reeve was in my opinion, and he did other roles, but Christopher Reeve was Superman, and I think
he locked it down so well, and he nailed it. Nobody else at that time period could have done it as well as he did.
Right, and again, obviously, you know, we have, you know, the new Superman, Man of Steel, with the new Batman, with Dawn of Justice and Justice League, and I get that. But for me, Christopher Reeve, I mean, he owned it from head to toe.
Yes.
And for me, and of course I was much younger, it's very difficult for me to think, and I honestly can't think of another movie that Christopher Reeve was in besides the Superman movies.
Time after time.
Again, didn't see it. Or maybe I see it, but I can't recall him mm-hmm. because I have that outfit, I have that suit.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not saying that's a bad thing. I mean, mm-hmm. it paid his bills.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but Michael, that's the thing, maybe the irony is, Michael Keaton, I thought when he was picked for Batman, I thought it was a strange pick in 1989.
Everybody did.
Right, I thought too. And I was very hesitant because for me, you know, I was an Adam West fan, you know, the TV series.
Mm-hmm.
I had many of the comic books. And so I, you know, Batman's still my favorite. Still, even today, my favorite. And so I was very hesitant of Michael. You know, he wasn't as tall as maybe an actor should be. Mm-hmm. And that sounds a little nasty, but you know, Christopher Reeve was very tall mm-hmm. for Superman. But I loved it. I love Michael Keaton because he brought that mystique. You know, that, you know, not as confident as, you know, other superheroes would be. Mm-hmm. You know, I will admit I love the Val Kilmer movie. I love the Clooney movie. I know I'm a big Batman guy.
So you like the nippled bat suit from Clooney.
Well, I mean, obviously I'm sure the ladies liked it more than me. But, I mean, you know, I'm not going to knock it. Because, again, I'm a Batman fan. Mm-hmm. But then, of course, when the news, you know, the Christopher Nolan series kicked off, I was head over heels, you know. Well, so, but
anyway,
but anyway,
but you know, just the layers that were pulled back on this character, I just thought was so fascinating. And then, you know, he framed it in such a way is that I really don't think a normal editing style would have helped this film.
Would have worked.
No, just because you saw him peeling himself down. You saw the character just kind of peeling it down to the get to the core to the end of the movie. It's just that, you know, him taking his theatrical costume off and taking off his toupee, and right. he just kept on, you know, exposing more and more and more of himself to the very end of the film when he had nothing left to show.
True, especially with the ending, which I don't want to give away, or at least the ending of the play, which was a twist ending in
yes.
the play.
Yeah, there was nothing left. You know, it was a make or break at time, and it just and the ending. I'm like, you know.
Yeah, let's not give it away, right? I mean, I'm still debating what the real ending is as well.
It's been up for debate. In fact, the director, there are articles out there that talk about it. You know, and it's not even on his IMDb page or even the Birdman IMDb page. But there are places out there where it's been debated to death. But it just, I liked it so much, and it just, and every time I see it, I just, you know, it just, I felt like, yeah, there was no other way of doing it.
Well, again, and so I'll ask you one other question here, Patrick. If and I think this is important to me, and I hopefully to the listeners, is, you know, what if you had this concept for Birdman, you know, the script? Let's just say the script of the, you know, the superhero actor looking for a second role, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Would you have done this with minimal takes? Would you have gone the same way? I mean, is this something that all directors think of? Is this like, hey, I want to do a thing with no cuts? Is this something in their craw?
There's always a challenge to saying, like, how far can I do this without a take? Can I do something in one huge long take? I mean, that's always a challenge.
Okay.
You know, and all the films I have made or I've assisted with or been in, not once did I think about, well, why don't we do the whole thing all at once?
Right. Well, and that's my that I guess that's what I'm most curious about, since you have that side of the house, so to speak, in the back end.
Well, it's just I've never considered trying to do one, just because the amount of prepping time would be 4 or 5 times longer than.
Right, and
a normal one.
And you'd have to get all the actors on board.
Everybody
you'd have to get the you know the director of photography, all the crew, right? I mean,
it would be choreographed almost like a dance sequence, and it just you just can't say, okay, go on the set and riff what you're going to do, but make sure you hit all the lines. The length of dialogue had to match with what they were doing, where they were walking, what they were touching. It's just that, you know, it's just, you know, the rehearsal in this must have been insane.
Is that why, and again, without revealing any much of the plot, is that why so much of this movie is filmed indoors in the theater? Because, I mean, there's some outdoor shots, but not much.
I read about that. It's just that, it was done in one location, attempted to be done in one location to minimize the difficulty of trying to move the camera around or find a place to cut. You know, just that they use the hallways a lot in here. Every time that, you know, if you notice that they duck into a dark hallway, briefly it was dark, and then they came back out in the light. I'm suspecting, I don't know this for a fact, that's where some of the cuts took place. Also, this was still done on film.
Not digital.
It wasn't digital because this was 2014. I don't recall ever seeing, and please write in and tell me if I'm wrong about this. I don't see it saying that it was done digitally. I
Yeah,
think
no, I
this.
mean,
I don't recall ever seeing that. So if this was done digitally, that made less of a headache entirely because then they could have used smaller cameras and things like this. But no, I think this was still done on film, which
okay.
then meant that he not only had to figure out where to put the cameras, where to make the cuts, but how big of a film magazine he was using, and keep track of all that fun stuff. So, the technical parts of this was a more of a headache than actual making the film itself.
And I think if anybody wants to, I mean, obviously, please write into Patrick or to any of us, including me. But I guess what I'd be most curious is, what did people think? What do you think of the ending? What is the ending? Where is it
We want
going?
to know your interpretation of the ending,
Yes,
just because I have my, which is their right opinion.
Whatever, Patrick.
And then Larry has his, but
Yes,
granted, yeah, it's been several years old, and we're still going to not spoil anything because we don't want to influence it. Because if we describe the ending, we may be influencing the
Right. Then you
ending.
may say, "Oh yeah, it's Larry's interpretation." No, it's
Yeah.
Patrick.
No,
Patrick's
so
right.
we're going to leave that out for now. But please write in about that. Also, if there is a film that you find unique, such as one takes or whatever, let us know. Maybe we will review and talk about it in a upcoming episode. But what we're going to do is we're going to take a quick break here, and we're going to come back, and then what we're going to do is talk about an interesting TV series that's out right now. And we're to commercial now. Hey, Larry, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
When was the last time you listened to music?
Just a couple hours ago, just recently.
Oh, well, when you hear something, do you go like, wow, who did that?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, sometimes I do that. I mean, music, Patrick, as I think your listeners know and we know, it's a part of movies. Theme songs play a big part of some movies.
Like Close Encounters,
Jaws,
Star Wars,
2001.
Indiana Jones,
And TV shows.
X-Files,
Cheers, Star
Star Trek.
Trek, come on.
Now, without music, those movies and TV shows wouldn't work, right?
Absolutely.
Now, those musicians are really the rock stars of those films and
And
TV series.
absolutely, and we here at Geek Culture Online want all those musicians out there to become just as memorable.
Hey, we need you. Now, if you like writing and performing music and would like to contribute to this podcast, write me at patrick@geekculture.online, and in the subject line, put music talent. Include a link to your work so we can listen to your stuff.
Show off to all your friends and family, providing to them that carrying around a guitar on your back isn't just for show and to pick up groupies, although that is very nice.
Yes, it is.
Anyway, this will showcase what you can do, and who knows, maybe you'll be on your way to become the next John Williams, who, by the way, if I'm correct, today's his birthday.
Yes, today is his birthday.
Happy birthday, John Williams, 87 years old, and he's done the soundtrack already for Solo.
Yeah, oh yes. Yes,
Yes,
yes, yes.
that's already in the
He's
can.
87? I thought he was younger.
I thought I was 80.
Wow,
I'd
that's
have to, but
amazing.
well, I mean, think about it. I mean, when was Star Wars?
77.
Right, so that's over 40 years ago.
Yeah.
Did he do Jaws?
Yes.
That was 75.
Yes. That was
So,
only 2 years
oh,
difference.
okay, but I mean, so that's 42 years ago. He's been conducting film scores for 42 years.
Well, his first one, I do believe, was in 72.
Okay, but I'm saying so that's 46 years, okay? All pretty much 46 years. So figure he wasn't 10 when he started.
Well, no.
Okay, so
Well, yeah, anyway. All
anyway.
right. Well, write in and tell and get us some stuff here, okay? So you can listen to your music and brag about it to all your friends and family.
Thanks, guys and
Thanks.
ladies.
Yep. And welcome back. Now, we're going to talk about a TV show to continue our animal theme. And this one's going to be the TV series BoJack Horseman. Yay! This came out in 2014. It's right now on its fourth season. The fifth one is going to be coming out this year, and this is being shown on Netflix. Now, as part of the promotion for this title, Netflix created an original entry for the fictional horsing around on their site. If a user selects this, it plays the intro theme for the sitcom, which is shown in other episodes within the show proper, and then takes them back to the main menu.
Anyway, the creator of the show is Raphael Bob Waxberg. Raphael Bob Waxberg was born on August 17, 1984 in San Mateo, California.
Why do I feel old?
Well, okay, let's not go there. As Raphael Matthew Bob Waxberg. He is a writer and producer known for BoJack Horseman from 2014, Save Me from 2013, and Old English Comedy, The Sketch Pilot from 2008.
I've seen that, and I love that.
Now, never saw it.
Now, the plot of BoJack Horseman was that he was a star of a TV hit series called Horsin' Around in the 90s. Now he's all washed up, living in Hollywood, complaining about everything, and wearing colorful sweaters. Almost kind of like the plot line of Birdman, if you really think about it.
A little bit.
Somebody that had something, lost it, and is now trying to regain it. Right. Now,
The main characters and the main stars, Will Arnett of SNL fame. He plays BoJack Horseman. He's done 49 episodes from 2014 to 2017. Amy Sedaris, fantastic, lover.
Mm-hmm.
Princess Carolyn, also in all 49 episodes. Allison Brie is Diana Wen, same thing, 49 episodes. Aaron Paul, great actor. Todd Chavez, 49 episodes. And one of my favorite comedians, also a massive, massive talent on At Midnight, the show I've talked about, Paul F. Tompkins, who plays Mr. Peanut Butter in only 47 episodes from 2014 to 2017.
Now, Will Arnett is a Canadian-American actor, voice actor, and comedian. He plays George Oscar Gob Bluth II in the Fox series Arrested Development.
Great show.
Yeah. He also appeared in films such as The Lego Movie.
Playing Batman.
Uh-huh. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles in the 2014 one. And then the sequel, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Out of the Shadows in 2016, and then the Lego Batman movie, which is a continuation.
I loved it. Anyway, Amy Sedaris, she is an actress and writer and just fabulous woman. Honestly, just love her.
Mm-hmm.
Known for Puss in Boots.
Love that
Strangers
movie.
Strangers with Candy, absolutely. And an Elf. Also, The Star versus the Forces of Evil, which is a TV series.
Mm-hmm.
At Home with Amy Sedaris,
uh-huh.
another TV series, and No Activity, another TV series.
Yeah.
Funny woman, again, when she would be on Letterman, she's been in Colbert, you just never know what's going to come out of her mouth. I mean, oh my God, she talks about her godchildren, it's so off-putting, it doesn't make her uncomfortable, but she's just so funny.
Mm-hmm.
And she's such a good, like, I hate to use the term homemaker, but she's so good at, like, cooking and making things and like almost like an alt Martha Stewart. I think that's what I mean. She does regular stuff, but not in a regular way.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's Amy Sedaris. Allison Brie, I
love her.
Yeah, great actress, lovely. Has done a lot of TV series, Mad Men for one. Mm-hmm. She played Trudy Campbell. She's in Community, the TV series, playing Annie Edison.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Thorne, again, TV series, played Miss Dunstable.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Ken, the TV series.
I thought that was such a great show.
Okay, all right. Glow, the TV series, played Ruth Wilder. And, of course, in BoJack Horseman, playing Diana Wen, also Olivia, Vincent Adultman, and others. So she's just has a range. And you can just see from that list of TV series I listed, mm-hmm. fantastic range from Allison Brie.
Yeah, I first discovered her on Community, and I also watched Mad Men at the same time. So she was bouncing back between the two while both of them were on the air. And Dr. Ken, I loved that show. It was a really good comedy that just really wasn't given a chance.
Well, a lot of shows are like that, Patrick. Even though they're good, they're gone. You know, what can you do?
No.
Anyway, so Aaron Paul, we all know who Aaron Paul is.
Oh, yeah.
Breaking Bad, classic TV series, Jesse Pinkman. I mean, I think I saw Aaron Paul on an interview, and he says people still, even to this day, even though Breaking Bad's been off the 3-4 years off TV, I mean, it stopped because several years ago. Anyway, he says people basically on a daily basis still walk up to him and start swearing their heads off at him. They're bitching him out, basically. Anyway, of course, he's now known for BoJack Horseman, the TV series, playing Todd Chavez, also Skippy, also Prince Gustav.
Uh-huh.
He's also in Black Mirror, which is very popular TV series now, playing Gamer 691. Also in the TV series called The Path, plays a character played Eddie Lane. Now, I'm sure you want to talk about him, but Paul F. Tompkins, I have to admit, I didn't really know him as a comedian
Ah.
before he started appearing on At Midnight, which I think started in 2014.
I knew him from Comedy Bang Bang.
Oh, okay. You know him from okay, so Comedy Bang Bang, right? Which is one of his previous earlier TV series. But I just have to say, Paul F. Tompkins always. I mean, at least he's always on At Midnight. He's always in a, you know, a blazer, like a nice suit, usually a bow tie, if I remember properly, and always like he's always like the best well dressed on most shows. And I just love that because he brings a different. But it's almost very disarming. Think, oh, this is a nice prim and proper man, and then boom, he just hits you. I mean, he really does.
It's so
It's very off-putting.
yes.
I think in a way he is a little bit older than many of the comedians that used to be on At Midnight or mainly, I mean, older than Alison Brie, I'm sure, Aaron Paul. But he has, I think that's part of his shtick. You know, you think, oh, this is just a standard guy, you know, standard, you know, comedian or actor. But he has a lot more chops than people
Oh,
realize. And
yeah.
that's why I like him. That's why I like Paul F. Tompkins. Again, you mentioned Comedy Bang Bang, the TV series. He plays Lord Andrew Lloyd Webber, Sir Andrew Lloyd Webber,
He plays
Alan
Alan Thicke.
Thicke, and others, right? Then Adam Ruins Everything, another TV series. He plays Jenkins in that show. DuckTales, the TV series. He plays Gladstone Gander. Bob's Burgers, the TV series, which even I've watched.
I love that
My
show.
daughter loved Bob's Burgers. He plays Randy and Pierre and Bronconius and others. He's also in the TV series Blackish, which is a
Yes.
big, you know, tentpole ABC series.
That's getting a spin-off too.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. He plays Dr. Reagan. And Tangled, the TV series.
Yeah, for any all the Disney fans out there, he does the Tangled has a TV series that takes place between Tangled and the sequel.
Right, and he plays Shorty, you know, the character Shorty in that. So again, you know, a comedian just, you know, you expect, oh, just a standard, but he has so much more to offer. Just a great range, in my opinion.
Oh, I think so too. Now it's available at Netflix. You just look for it under the title. Now, the latest episode. Well, this is since because of the weather, we're kind of behind. But the latest episode, which I think was the last one, was series 4, episode 12, which was called "What Time Is It Right Now?" And Princess Caroline pitches Filbert to the company execs. Now Ty gets a better business idea, and Bo Jackman comes in to a realization about Hollyhock.
And in music, like we said, music is always an important part of any movie or TV series, Patrick. And Patrick Carney of the Black Keys recorded the theme to BoJack Horseman as a test of his new home studio with his uncle providing saxophone. The song was never intended to be used for anything until Carney was approached by the show's creators, who asked to use the track as an opening theme. Again, musicians, think of that. You think it's a throwaway, and somebody will value it and use it.
Now, to hop off on that idea, I listened to another podcast called My Favorite Murder. Now, it's done by two wonderful, wonderful ladies. Now, I think it was Georgia that's doing the guitar, but they were banking around what they want to do for a podcast, and she and they came up with this idea for their podcast. And ladies, I love you. Is that basically? It's they talk about murders and how the police solve them or unsolved murders and about serial killers. Now she picked up her guitar and did this quick riff, saying like, "Oh, I want our theme song to be something like this."
Quick riff, you mean? Riff.
Yeah,
Riff. A riff.
and so it was about 20 seconds long, and they use it for the theme song because it was too perfect. There wasn't any way they can build off of that,
Right.
and so it's just her.
Right. I mean, just think about, I mean, we're talking about BoJack Horseman, which is a, you know, a Netflix show. But I mean, think about when you think about music, right? You think about, you know, people know Friends. People know the Friends theme, right? It's a very simple theme. You know, you think of the X-Files, which we talked about before. That's an iconic, you know, again, it's instrumental, right? An iconic song. When I hear that, I think immediately of X-Files. I think of nothing else but X-Files. Think of, you're gonna go way back. Think of Miami Vice. You know, the TV show Miami Vice. That there's that opening, which is like a staccato, like a machine gun. So there's certain songs, whether it be, you know, on instruments or, you know, electronic drums or keyboards, that when you hear them, like certain musicians' voices, you know, you hear, you instantly go to a song, not necessarily a again, the Star Wars theme.
Right.
I mean, you open Star Wars, you know exactly what you're getting.
So that's what makes Horace Jackman's songs. It just everything, all the stars aligned for that.
Right. I mean, again, it's just rare for an animated series.
Well, yeah, and just talking about going back to this is that now. I don't know speaking from the technical point of view, I don't know if anybody knows how an animated cartoon is made. It's basically everybody is handed a script. They come in on their own, when they have time, and it's just one person in a booth. One person's in there saying their lines. They're not interacting with anybody else. And they say their lines multiple different ways, and then somebody else comes along and says the opposite lines. They're reacting to nobody multiple different ways, and they go in there and edit the whole thing together. What makes this so unique is that they do a table read of every single episode. They all sit down and do a table read of the script, so that all the actors and actresses are interacting with each other, so they know their tempo, they know the zingers, they know all the points, which is completely, utterly unique for any
animated series. But maybe that's why it works more. Maybe why the show is popular. Maybe because the people, when they're doing their lines, their actual lines for the show, for the animated series, maybe they're just so more comfortable understanding.
Yeah, they know what's going to happen. They know what the other person's
going to
do.
I think that makes sense. I mean, I understand why they don't do it that way, why most animated series don't. But I think the table read and sitting, if you and I were in a series, mm-hmm. Patrick, I would want to do the table read so I can kind of get
through. Yeah, I wouldn't want to think that there was anything was rehearsed about it.
Right, of course not. Anyway, in the first scene of episode one, BoJack is being interviewed about the success of the show, Horsing Around, his mm-hmm. show from the 90s. BoJack says, "It's not Ibsen," referring to the playwright Henrik Ibsen. Of course. In a later episode, BoJack has a flashback to his mother watching the filming of Horsing Around. When asked what she thought of the show, she says, it's not Ibsen.
A long running gag, because that was in the first episode, I believe, when they asked for that. That was in series three, I believe. And okay. Yeah, correct me if I was wrong.
No. Send him an email.
Yes.
Yeah, but anyway, this is funny. The characters' outfits are often based on real life pieces, which prompted a fan, believe it or not, to start the blog bojackfashion.tumblr.com,
which is still live today.
Okay, where they post the real life version of the show's clothing or lookalikes.
Yeah, because Bo Jackman wears these really awful, awful sweaters, which are based on real life sweaters. So you can go there and see the real, what the real equivalency would be of this. Now, this show has become so popular. It's won several awards. The Critics' Choice Award for 2016. It won the Critics' Choice TV's sort of Best Animated Series. The Gold Derby Awards in 2017 for Best Animated Series. It won the same one in 2016. The Golden Trailer Awards in 2017. It was nominated for Golden Trailer for Best Animated /TV spot/trailer/teaser for a series. I mean, just bam, 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 all these awards. Now, it's become so popular that there's actually a fake website for Bo Jackman. It's bojackman.com. Go there. It's very interactive.
I've never been there, so I want to check that out. I think that's funny. So that there's the official website. Then there's this Tumblr site, which some fan started, which is interesting. And then there's bojackman.com, which is a fake website.
Yeah, and it's kind of almost done in such a way that it kind of reminds you of something from the 90s. Now, Netflix releases everything all at once. So, you're able to watch them, you're able to watch everything, the whole entire season all at one time,
You can binge if you want.
Yeah, you binge the whole thing. Now, the fifth season is in the can. It has not been released yet. Since this particular podcast was delayed, I haven't checked back to see if there is a scheduled time for release yet. But oh my god, I can't wait for this. He's a such a fascinating character. The stuff that's come out of the show is now part of the lexicon.
Right, but let's be honest, Patrick. you know, it's an odd show. I understand there's a lot of animation these days, you know, with, I get it, South Park and what have you, and I'm not, you know, taking shots at anything. I mean, I love South Park, but this is just a strange bird. You know, I mean, it's a strange premise, number one.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, similar to Birdman, but again, still a strange premise. And then it's animated, which throws you off, thinking, oh, it's cutesy, which I know it's not. Like, South Park is always cutesy. And then, you know, they have, you know, Sedaire and just have the cast. I mean, you know, usually you don't get a strong cast like this. So, I haven't heard anything about when the fifth, you know, when this season, I you know, 2018 is coming soon.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't had any more details, but, you know, write us in, give us feedback, you know, post it on the Facebook page, you know, so all listeners can and podcast listeners can keep track.
There are some. This is so, you know, so popular. There are several YouTube videos about, like, the best of the highlights from the last four seasons. Now there is one that highlights his sweaters, and it just that one I love to death. I can't praise this one enough. It's wonky enough that it just it's going to be one of those things you either hate it or you're going to like it. Now you can see how all this ties together about our animal theme, a Squirrel Girl, Birdman, and BoJack Horseman. If there's any other animal themed stuff, TV series, movies, or comic books that you want to talk about, please write in and tell us. But
right. Tweet us.
Instagram us, Tumblr us. We're all over the place. I'm even on Google Plus. So, yeah, you could find me anywhere.
Google Plus.
Yes.
That's an exciting platform, Patrick.
And that's where I put all my stuff.
Of course.
Now, we here all at Geek Culture Online would really like to thank everybody for listening, taking time to do this. I greatly appreciate you taking time out of your day to do this. And, hey, we're all geeks here. We all love the same thing. So please go to our webpage at geekculture.online. Interact. Take the there's always things to do on there. There's a little, please comment on all our podcasts and all the stuff that's on there. Now, you can also find us on Facebook at Geek Culture Online. We're on Instagram at Geek Culture Online. Twitter, Your Geek Culture.
Tweet us.
Yeah, tweet. Tweet all over the place. Now, you can write me directly at Patrick at Geek Culture Online. You can reach Larry at Geek Culture Online.
Hey.
And like us on Facebook. Comment on our websites. Please, if you don't tell us, we're just going to keep doing what we like. Now, check out our previous episodes on our website and soon to be on iTunes, where I'm working on that feverishly. Now, you're going to be able to find us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, or you're going to be able to find us at Stitcher and other places like that. But right now, our podcasts are available on our website. Now, until next week, I'm Patrick Bullen.
I'm Larry Wojciechowski.
Thank you again for Geek Culture Online, your destination of all things geek. And hey, thank you, mate, for this line. Keep your geek flag flying. And good night.
Bye-bye.